Rock and Roll Rebels, and welcome to another episode of Ramble On with Rosie. First off, happy Halloween, everybody. Have a fun time tonight. Be safe. Look out for yourselves. Look out for the kiddos. If you're an adult drinking adult beverages, get an adult to drive you home. And beyond that, just have fun. Enjoy yourselves. Go enjoy the last of the nice weather if you're having nice weather where you're at, which I hope you are. Have fun dressing up. If you dress up as a rock star, I would love to see pictures. I personally will be going as a science officer in the original series Starfleet slash a little bit Nurse Chapel inspired. So I'll share pictures of that on my Instagram, which is at RambleOnWithRosie. And that's my Halloween plans, is seeing Dune in a Starfleet uniform because I'm a sci-fi nerd. But yeah, so check out the Insta for that. I'll try to remember to take pictures. And that out of the way, we'll get to the real reason you're hopefully here, which is the music. In suit with the somber season that is fall, and because last week's episode about the Ramones got me thinking about other tragic rock and roll bands, I felt like, y'all should be extra sad, as if the Ramones weren't sad enough. So, we're gonna discuss Badfinger this week. JK, I didn't actually want everybody to be sad, but one sad thing led to another, and Badfinger is possibly the most tragic rock and roll act in music history. Like, it's just sad. So, maybe grab a box of tissues, but I'll try to keep it upbeat. Can't change the facts of the great Badfinger contract, though. It's still a sad story. So, be prepared. There is no happy ending here. But, it's a good story, and the best ending to this would be to remember that this band was awesome and check them out because they're great and don't get enough credit. Like, they're seriously overlooked and underestimated, and they were freaking awesome. So, that's the upswing of this, is hopefully by doing this episode, maybe I can shed some light on the ill-fated band Badfinger and get some people into their music, because I mean, that's why I do this, is to try to turn people on to obscure acts that they may not have heard of, and or provide maybe insights that nobody had thought of, or at least I thought of and maybe somebody else agrees with, about musical acts that I do like. So that's why I'm here. Hopefully y'all appreciate and enjoy, and we'll just dig into the history of Badfinger here. So they initially started in Wales with band member Pete Ham in the Swansea area, and they were known as the Ivies. In fact, they would be known as the Ivies from 1961-ish. They went through a couple band name changes, but the band started in 1961 and was known as the Ivies within a year or two after some name changes, and then was known as Badfinger from 1969 onwards. So if I call the Ivies Badfinger, bear with me, it may happen. It's the same band, just with a different name. So they're playing in Wales, doing the pub scene, basically kind of being like the Beatles were before the Beatles went to Germany, came back, got signed, and changed the face of music. Speaking of the Beatles changing the face of music, one of the things that the Beatles did that was super important and I don't feel gets acknowledged enough is that prior to the Beatles, in Britain, if you were a musical act and you were not from London and the general London area, your chances of getting signed were basically nil. You were screwed. You might be popular in your area. You might be booking out every club, Thursday through Sunday nights, and you would never get any further. There was going to be no record deal. Nobody was going outside of the capital to discover new acts. You had to come to the capital. So that's the situation. And the Beatles kind of broke that a little bit because they weren't from London. They definitely weren't. You hear them open their mouths and those big Liverpool accents come out, and you're like, oh, they're definitely not from the capital. So the Beatles sort of busting open the music industry in Britain to where you could potentially get signed while not being from the capital was pretty cool. But for the most part, you still had to go to London if you wanted to get discovered. unfortunately, a vehicle of that nature came to the Ivies. The former road manager of the Kinks discovered the Ivies in 1966 and brought them to London, and he even let them stay in his house. So here's Bill Collins, former road manager of the Kinks, with not one, but two bands in his house, because there was another band, I think it was called the Mojos or something. Anyway, so he's got the Ivies and this other band all staying in his house, which is kind of cool, and I kind of wonder where that generous spirit that was, like, basically a continuation of, you know, the patrons back in the old days of the arts, that spirit of patronage, like, went. Because, I mean, it's hard to be a musician and eat. So somebody, you know, taking you under their wing is a good thing. And Bill Collins became the manager for the Ivies. And they're staying in his house. So it's just, you know, like, this whole fostering of the arts and talent when you find it, I think is just really beautiful and astonishing. And I don't know where that sort of openness and generosity went. But maybe if it came back, so would the arts. Who knows? But they do well in London. They end up doing so well playing, you know, the clubs and stuff that this pop singer named David Garrett has them as his permanent backing band. They end up doing so well at that gig that David Garrett fires them because he suffers from LSD, lead singer disorder, and did not appreciate a band garnering more attention than he was as the front, you know, singer. So he booted the Ivies, but they still end up doing pretty well. Through the Kinks connection from Bill Collins, Ray Davies ends up discovering them and taking an interest. And so he gets them into the studio to record some demos. And, you know, they've got about three songs recorded. I forgot which record company it was. It wasn't Decca. But anyways, they offer it to, I think it was Columbia. And Columbia's not interested. But they're still gigging and, you know, trying to live. Living in their manager's house. And the London nightlife ends up distracting their guitar player. So they have to replace him. And they get this guy named Tom Evans from Liverpool, who also happens to be a capable songwriter, who will end up pinning their first single, maybe tomorrow. But as of yet, it's not out yet. It's not written yet. It's still only, 1967. In 1968, however, the demos that they made with Ray Davies end up making it into the hands of fellow Liverpudlians, the Beatles. So the Beatles hear the Ivies demos, and all four of them unanimously agree that they should be the first non-Beatles musical acts on Apple Records. Which, it's 1968, and all four of the Beatles are agreeing on something, so that says something about the sheer impressive power of Badfinger. Well, the Ivies at the time, still. You know, things are disintegrating within the Fab Four, and all four of them are agreeing that, hey, the Ivies rock. So, they sign them as Apple's first non-Beatles musical act. They end up, around this time, after they get signed to Apple, the bass player leaves. He's got a young family he's trying to take care of, and he doesn't really fit in with the living in the manager's house scene while trying to raise a 10-month-old. It's just not the right spot. So he leaves. But before he does, he issues this scathing interview in one of the music magazines about how, you know, Apple's just sort of mismanaging them, not really, you know, making sure that they get what they need to, like, put out a good record and stuff. And just, you know, sort of shreds them. Fortunately, his contribution to the band in this regard is not overlooked, because Paul McCartney reads this article in the magazine where Ron Griffiths was being interviewed, and was like, oh, that band that we all liked, I think they need help. So he comes to Badfinger with a song that he was writing for Ringo's screwball movie, The Magic Christian, which is just a bizarre hodgepodge of comedy with an array of cameos, and it's just mental. I haven't seen it, but just reading the summary, I'm like, they did what with the what and the huh? So, really trippy film. It's got Peter Sellers in it too, and like I said, a bunch of cameos, but the lead roles are played by Ringo and Peter Sellers, which that alone makes it sound crazy. But he's got this song called Come and Get It that he wrote for Ringo's new movie. And Paul lets Badfinger record it. Not only that, but he's so impressed with Badfinger that he sort of delegates the writing of two other songs, because he had promised three songs for the film, to Badfinger, which is just, really cool. Also around this time, after, because like Griffiths is decamping after roasting Apple, Paul's getting involved with, the Ivies, and but also around this time, so Evans replaces Griffiths on bass guitar, and they pull in another guy from Liverpool named Joey Mullen. So like half this band is Liverpudlian and half of it's Welsh, sort of. So that's the makeup right as starting to get traction with this assistance from McCartney. So they do the McCartney song and the two other songs for the Magic Christian, which are Carry On Till Tomorrow, which is a beautiful song, and Rock of All Ages. I grew up with the Best of Badfinger album on CD, played the heck out of it. I think it only has the songs from when they're with Apple Records, not from the later albums. But so all these songs, I'm just sort of like, ah, nostalgia. I remember listening to this when I was like 6 years old. So Carry On Till Tomorrow was always one of my favorite songs. Rock of All Ages is a really rockin' number, and Come and Get It is like the first song on that CD, and I played the heck out of it. My dad didn't like it, I did. My dad doesn't like loud, boisterous music as much as I do. And Come and Get It is fun, catchy, and, really good. I mean, Paul McCartney wrote it. He usually writes pretty good songs. So anyways, after they record Come and Get It, they end up changing their name to Badfinger. So here it is, 1969, they finally are dropping the Ivies in favor of being called Badfinger, which they based off of the working title for A Little Help from My Friends, which Lennon was calling Badfinger Boogie. So a Beatles-based name, though no one would really know that, until this was shared with the world, but Badfinger, based off of Badfinger Boogie, which was the working title for A Little Help from My Friends. Unfortunately, Badfinger would end up needing a lot of help and having no friends by the end of things. But for now, they are doing well. Like I said, they've got, a competent bass player in Evans who moved from guitar. They've got a good guitar player in Joey Mullen from Liverpool, who also happens to be a decent songwriter. So the talent is there. The assistants will end up falling off. And things end up taking their help from the Beatles and the Kinks and everything. They have their own bands and their own drama, and Badfinger ends up getting left to sort of be set adrift. But we'll get to that part in a minute. For right now, things are good. Come and Get It becomes a global hit. Fans even theorized that Badfinger was just a pseudonym for the Fab Four, because around this time it's been announced that, the Beatles are breaking up. So they're like, oh, the Beatles are just recording under this other name, and Badfinger's really the Beatles, which come the tour in that fall in America, everybody is like, these are definitely not Paul, George, John, and Ringo. These are four separate individuals. They just have mop tops too, and sing in a similar vein of music, but once you've listened to Badfinger, you're like, you can hear some similarities, but it's not, the same. So they're doing well. They're touring. They're about to do their second album, which is a success. It's called No Dice, and this is also around the time that while Apple Records is having some issues, Badfinger's issues begin, because in 1970, they sign with a new manager, because Bill Collins realizes, like, he can't keep up with everything they're trying to do, he can't manage them credibly, so he helps them get a new manager, naively. They end up hiring a man named Stan Polley, who, just a year later, will be name-dropped in a Senate investigation hearing in relation to having ties to an unnamed organized crime member. So it's theorized that he was a bagman for the mob. And Stan Polly takes over managing Badfinger and ends up reorganizing their finances in a way that might even make Colonel Tom Parker blush. Like, I'm not saying Stan Polly's the worst manager in the history of music, but I'm saying I can't think of anybody worse than him. And that's saying something. Like, I think I'd pick Billy Joel's brother-in-law over him. It's bad. Just wait. It's bad. Like, he reorganized their finances into, like, the Badfinger Corporation and then had all these other little sub-corporations, which basically turned into black holes that absorbed all of the band's income. I mean, it didn't help that by the time of their third album, Apple is kind of disintegrating, and so they had to basically, some of their publishing rights and funds were sort of held up in that, and it took forever. And there's other stuff, but mainly they would have been making decent money had Stan Polly not been just fleecing the hell out of them. But they're not aware of that quite yet. This is only, 1970, 1971. Artistically, they're still excelling. Their third album, Straight Up, has both Todd Rundgren and George Harrison on producing credits. The latter would also feature some of Badfinger on his epic All Things Must Pass album. You know, that thing that's like three CDs long? That one that George Harrison did? They're on it. John Lennon and Ringo Starr also use some and all of the Beatles on various solo projects. John Lennon uses them on his Imagine album, and Ringo Starr, I can't remember which song. Trying to think. It Don't Come Easy, I believe, is the song that he used, like, a couple members from Badfinger on to back him. So, that's pretty cool. You know, the Beatles are still nurturing them and taking care of them, even though the Beatles have sort of went their separate ways from each other. Stan Polly ends up arranging a new deal with Warner Brothers as Apple Records is disintegrating, and it seems promising. It sounds like, we're gonna get millions. Like they're promise, they've got these big advances on their records. However, they're supposed to provide an album every 6 months, which that plus almost incessant touring could take a wear on any band, and the strain will end up showing shortly, unfortunately. So. The Warner Brothers contract stipulates an album every 6 months, and they're doing well. They're touring. They're providing. They've provided their first album to Warner Brothers, and Warner Brothers starts to wonder just where did that advance money we put in escrow for the band go? Because the band didn't get it, so. What happened? So they start investigating Stan Polly. They take up a legal suit against Badfinger's manager. Unfortunately, this meant that they also pulled Badfinger's second album after it was only on the market for 7 weeks. It was sort of like collateral damage for this, lawsuit they were now pulling against the band slash the band's manager. So that was not helpful. Also, there was some slightly unfortunate timing with Badfinger's first Warner Brothers release, which was it was released the same time as Apple finally released Badfinger's fourth and final album for Apple. So that was their first strike one with Warner Brothers, is they had bad timing because Apple finally released Badfinger's fourth album right as Badfinger's fifth album, now with Warner Brothers, was being released. And then strike two. The second album is pulled after not even being on the market for 2 months because it's collateral damage in the lawsuit they're now pulling with Stan Polly. So this is just all too much. And guitarist, Joey Molland, like the last band member to join, basically, is the first to leave. He quits the band. Everybody else in the band has been threatening to quit and being talked into staying multiple times by now. Like, the wheels are starting to come off. And so they're still trying to keep this Badfinger boat afloat. Polly pushes them to make a third album for Warner Brothers called Head First, and he's kind of hoping to use a completed album as like a bargaining chip with Warner Brothers in their legal pursuit of them. He's gonna be like, hey, well, don't do this because I've got a finished album now, so I'll give you the finished album if you do this and this. He thinks he can use it to bargain with, except for unfortunately, it backfires horribly. I mean, not unfortunate. I would love to see Polly, screwed, but unfortunately, he just passes on his losses to the band. But Warner Brothers refuses to release the album. They refuse to even pay for it. They're just like, nope, we don't want it. We're suing you. We don't care. We don't care that there's an album. We just want to cut our losses, because, I mean, it is the business. Unfortunately, nobody at Warner Brothers is like, is the band still getting to eat? How they doing over there? No concern for the band, just for the profits. And the band's paltry little salary checks even end up stopping. So they haven't been getting any of their royalties or any of that, any of their road money. They've only been getting these salary checks, and now the salary checks are stopping because Polly's like, well, I'm gonna have to cut my losses too, so I'm just not gonna pay the band anymore, right? That's totally fair. So that's the situation, which is just horrible, bleak, and ugly. It's like 1973, 1974. So here's this band with all this promise, they could have been carrying on like the popularity and legacy of the Beatles somewhat. They had some similarities, but they were also like adapting to the new times and changing. Good. Like they could have been, a consistent hit making. They had commercial appeal without being total like commercialist generic sounding sellouts. So like they have all this potential, but they're just sinking. And unfortunately, with the situation being as it is, potential new managers and booking agents are they don't want to touch Badfinger with a 10-foot pole. So there's no one to save them. 'Cause like even if somebody was like, yo, they're getting screwed over there and need a better manager. The contracts with Stan Polly were so convoluted that it would have been a legal nightmare trying to get them free of him, was something Polly, I'm sure, was very aware of when he wrote those contracts. Which just makes me sad, because I'm like, if Badfinger had had Bad Company's manager, I think they might have not suffered the tragic fates that they did, because, well, Peter Grant was basically built like Hercules, but bigger in all dimensions. And something that big and tall standing over somebody. Like, basically, Peter Grant needed to go beat up Stan Polly for the good reputation of all managers everywhere. I want this to happen. I'm like, had they had a manager who was protective of his band, like Peter Grant was for Led Zeppelin and Bad Company, then maybe it would have been different. Because there are some similars, not musically, but like Bad Company was the first signee for Led Zeppelin's Swan Songs, Badfinger's the first signee for the Beatles, Apple Records. So, some similarities there. Unfortunately, Bad Company had the best manager in the industry, probably, and Badfinger had the worst. So they're stuck. Booking agents don't want to deal with it. There's song rights issues trying to get those from Apple Records. There's the Warner Brothers lawsuit, and there's the convoluted contracts with Polly, which basically makes them nobody wants to go near them. So I'm sure there were other managers and people in the industry that are like, I feel sorry for them, but I don't know what I can do to help them because it's just a mess that might ruin my career if I got involved. So they're being left to their own devices, which is not a good thing. Because Polly basically goes MIA. Cannot be found, cannot be got a hold of. Pete Ham, who's like, basically the lead, I mean, he's the main singer, and he's the rhythm guitar player, and he's the longest standing band member. Like, he started the Ivies way back when in Swansea in Wales. And he's still there, so he's trying, to be the leader and get a hold of Polly, but you know, he can't. He's fallen off the map and is not available. And Pete Ham has the own personal stresses of, you know, his girlfriend is pregnant and due in a month, and he can't provide. Like, he's over here about to become a father, and he can't provide for his family because he has no money. He's been working his ass off for, you know, in various forms of the same band for over 10 years, and has essentially nothing to show for it. Because remember, like, Polly stopped the salary checks. So they have no income. They've done all this work, and none of the band is getting in any income from it. So, after going out for drinks with bandmate Tom Evans, Pete Ham, 3 days before his 28th birthday, went home and hung himself in his garage. Because, you know, and his suicide note is very to the point. It's short, and it's pretty much, "I will not be allowed to love and trust everybody. This is better." And then he lays the blame for this directly at the feet of the man where it belongs. P.S. Stan Polly is a soulless bastard. I will take him with me. It's moments like this that you kind of wish that, you know, hauntings were real. Because Stan Polly definitely deserved, like, some gruesome horror movie ending after what he did to these guys. But sadly, in this case, I don't often wish for spooky things to be real, but vengeful spirits would be nice in this case, because Polly deserved one hell of a haunting. Sadly, he ends up surviving, like, most of the band, and going on to do future nefarious deeds. But, you know, so Ham's girlfriend finds him the next morning, calls up Tom Evans, who he'd just been out drinking with the night before, and so Evans has the very unfortunate task of cutting down his friend and bandmate. And, well, I mean, that sort of ends the band, you know. The lead singer's gone. There's no end to their legal issues. Everybody sort of goes off and takes up normal jobs. But about 7 years later, both Joey Moland and Tom Evans start up, like, their own respective Bad Fingers. So they're each are running around with a band called Bad Finger, touring, doing their thing. And that they're kind of at odds with each other over this a little bit too. They're also at odds wondering when the hell Apple's ever going to release the publishing funds for some of their songs, because this has been going on for like over a decade now, and they're like, you know, Ham's estate's not getting this money, we're not getting this money. We should be, because, I mean, some of their songs, like Without You, which both Harry Nilsson and, not yet, but later on in the 90s, Mariah Carey will cover, you know, that they're due those publishing funds. Because, you know, they wrote the song. So they should get royalties even when other people cover it, and they haven't seen a dime. So they're frustrated. They're at least back in the music business after working as taxi cab drivers and carpet layers and other normal jobs, but they're sort of got these rival Bad Finger bands. Unfortunately for Evans, he signs with another bad manager. There's this guy from Milwaukee named Cass, who is not only unscrupulous, but he's also inept. He'd never really done anything in the music business before, and after stalling and failing to fulfill on any of his promises for a couple months, Evans and the band just decamp back to Britain. They're like, "We've been to this rodeo before. We don't want to visit again. Bye." And then suddenly they're hit with a $5 million lawsuit from Cass for, like, breach of contract, which was somewhat, you know, nebulous in legality. So, but still, I mean, it irritates him. They've had enough legal issues already. Evans does not need any more of this in his life. So, in 1983, after having a phone conversation with former bandmate Joey Moland about the Apple publishing funds, Tom Evans says to his wife, "I'll be dead before I get the money." And then sometime later that night hung himself in his garden. And the following morning, his wife, Mrs. Evans, is woken up when her 6-year-old is like, "Mummy, there's a man standing in the garden." But it's his dad hanging from the tree in the backyard. So there goes two vastly talented men who basically driven to suicide by being so screwed over by managers and the legal machinations of the music industry. So, yeah. Badfinger is not a happy band to talk about. I mean, it's not pleasant, not a fun topic. But yeah, so they're both gone, and then 2 years after Tom Evans is commit suicide, Apple finally gets their act together and releases the publishing funds that they were owing to Badfinger. Of course, now it only gets to go to the estates of Pete Ham and Tom Evans, but it's finally released. In 2005, Mike Gibbons dies from a brain aneurysm, and that leaves Joey Mulland. And granted, Mulland and Gibbons had been at odds for a while. Fortunately, before Gibbons passed, they were on speaking terms, were having good conversations about the past, present, and future of Badfinger. And so at least the band, what was left of it, was on good terms before, Gibbons passed, leaving Mulland as the only member of the, classic lineup to this day. He's still around. He lives in America now and still does stuff in music and participates at, like, Beatles related events because, Badfinger being so closely linked to the Fab Four, they're sort of an associated act almost at this point. And so they, he still does musical stuff and is around, but sadly none of the other band members are. And, it's really sad when it's not natural causes. I mean, the Ramones are sad enough with cancer and stuff like that, but, suicide, losing band members. I mean, people talk about the 27 Club, but they forget to talk about Pete Ham, because he was 27 when he died. And a tragic, tragic case. And like I said, I don't often wish for hauntings and stuff like that to be real, but Stan Polly was a soulless bastard, and he could have done with a good heavy haunting on his ass. So, I guess the moral of Badfinger is to try to look out for people around you when they're going through hard times, 'cause you don't want another, you don't want to have to be the friend that gets called to cut them down in the morning. So, on that cheerful note, I promise I will try to find something happier to talk about next week. I've talked about the Ramones and now I've talked about Badfinger. I don't think I can get any sadder. I will try to find. Actually, I know what I'm talking about next week, and I mentioned the band's name in this ramble, but you'll have to wait till next week to figure out which band I name dropped that I'm going to be talking about. They have an album that has a 50th anniversary coming up, we'll put it that way. A very famous album. But that's your teaser for next week's trailer, next week's episode. And for now, for this week, have a great week. Be kind to each other. Have fun eating all the leftover Halloween candy, and I will see y'all next week, and rock on!